Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming to our talks. I'm Shinas Levine. And I have two affiliations here, as you can see. I'm from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And right now I'm affiliated. I'm a guest or visiting scholar at the Center for Knowledge Governance at Copenhagen Business School. And I will present a framework for understanding collective open source innovation. And if you do not understand the title, that's fine, because collective open source innovation is what the talk is about. I should say that this is world premiere. It's actually a new paper. It's a project that just began to bear fruits recently. And so you get the world premiere of the talk, and there are subsequent talks that are scheduled for the Druid Conference in Denmark, for the American Sociological Association Conference in San Francisco, and for the Academy of Management Conference in New Orleans over the summer. So any comments would be highly appreciated. I don't know what are the norms in the other talks, but if you do not understand something or you want a clarification or you have a comment, feel free to interrupt at any time. This is absolutely okay to raise your hand and say something. So here's a roadmap of what I'm going to talk about for the next 30 minutes or so. I'll start by talking about what is collective open source innovation. I'll convince you that collective open source innovation, or COSI, is prevalent and has significant economic impact, which means that it's something that we should care about. It is created by coordinated collectives as opposed to firms, for example, or companies. The products and services that are created in COSI are available to anyone, not only to the people that contributed to the manufacturing or the production of the goods and services. And it poses a puzzle to theory and practice. We do not understand why it works, and we do not understand when it works and when it would not work. And this is these are the questions that the framework that I'm going to present starts to address. I will talk about how the research was conducted, what are the research sites, which methods we use to collect the data, and I'll briefly present the results of the research. I think that most of the people here should be familiar with the results of the research, but people that come from outside this audience might not be familiar with that. So here I'll present the results only in brief. Then I'll move to talk about the framework. I will talk about the nature of the goods, which is non-rival goods. These are the goods or the services that are produced in collective open source innovation. And the ability to identify contributors to the collective effort. Then I will talk about two other elements that I argue help to make COSI effective in accomplishing its goals. And one of them is the fact that it is based on generalized exchange, and I will define that later. And the second is that it has a variety of coordination institutions that allow these loose collectives to coordinate their action and create the goods. I will end by talking about implications and some suggestions for future research. So let's go in. Let's start by talking about the important economic impact, and here you'll hopefully understand what I'm talking about when I talk about COSI. So a neat and common example is the open source software. The open source software has become a viable alternative to commercial products. I think that if you sit in this room, I don't have to convince you that this is true. You know that Apache, for example, is used much more than commercial products. You know that Linux is the only serious threat to the hegemony of Microsoft in operation systems. Now, there has been some attention in the scholarly literature, in the business literature, to the open source software. But collective open source innovation captures more than just the open source software. The next example is file sharing. If you think about the dynamics of file sharing, they are very similar to open source software. Now, we can sit here and debate whether file sharing is something good, whether it's something moral, whether it's something that we should do. But when I go to define collective open source innovation in a couple of minutes, you'll see that the guiding principles are very similar. File sharing is extremely common and arguably causes substantial revenue loss to copyright holders. There's an estimation by the Poor Internet Life Project, which is a U.S. project that conducts research on the Internet, and they found that about 30% of Internet users in the U.S., which is something like 36 million people, contributed something to the Internet. So this is a huge number of people that contributed something. Viruses and other attacks, which again, I argue, operate on very similar principles, caused wide-ranging disruption to businesses and individuals. And this is why I have so big in the name of this talk. So these are examples of collective open source innovation. It's not the definition yet. These are just examples to convince you that this is something that we should care about. This is something that is prevalent. It has important economic consequences. It's something that is worth studying. Now, the interesting thing is that COSY is created by collectives. Most of the production that we see around us in everyday life is production either by firms, by companies, which is a collective of people that are formally organized and declare their mission to produce a good or produce a service, or by individuals. COSY is none of this. It is produced by collectives that operate in coordination, accomplish innovative goals, which means that they create a product or service that was not there before. So even if you think about Napster, it created a service that was not there before. This service might be illegal, but it's still a service. Products or services have economic value and impact, but there is no formal hierarchy in organization. There is no CEO, nobody gets a salary. More than that, there is little social information and interaction, and there is strong orientation to accomplish goals rather than preserve relationships. So the first point says that we are not talking here about a firm in the usual sense of the word. We're not talking about a company. The two later points are about the fact that we also do not talk about community. A lot of people refer to COSY as being created by communities. What I argue that these are not communities in the sense that we typically use it in sociology. Community is a place where you care about the other people, where you ask them, you know, how's your wife doing? How are your kids? Think about a small village in which you meet your neighbors every day and you chat about life and so on. The primary goal in a community is to preserve the relationship with these people. You are there because you like the people, you like the relationship. In our research, what we see is that preservance of the relationship is not a primary goal of these people. These people are there to produce something, and this is what they care about. They care about the production. So it's interesting that their orientation is almost business-like orientation. On the other hand, they do not have the formal organization. They do not have the titles that you would expect in a company. Now, the products, the goods and services that are produced by COSY are openly available, and this is a second interesting point. They are available to anyone. There is no attempt to limit access, although technologically feasible. Now, these collectives that produce COSY could have operated like a co-op, like a cooperative. And we have examples of that in the real world, in which people contribute jointly to a public good, to a joint good, and then only the people that contributed something can enjoy that. So if you think about farmers or fishermen that together set up grazing area for their animals. Everyone contributes something. They create something that all of them can use, but only them can use it. Only the people that contributed could use it. And this is what we do not see in collective open source innovation. So there is no attempt to limit access. There's also no legal protection. They do not claim copyright. The only way in which they use the legal system is to keep access free. And this is another interesting twist. Usually the legal system is used to limit access. They use the legal system to make sure that access remains free, that nobody could take over, nobody could hijack the project and make it their own property. So we have a puzzle to theory here. First, we have a collective that doesn't look like anything else that we've studied. Second, they operate in ways that we do not understand why they make sense. So first, the primary question is why COSY is sustainable, how it avoids the tragedy of the commons. And I will just briefly talk about the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons is a term that was coined to describe cases of public goods in which everybody makes a contribution to the public good, and there is no good enforcement as to who uses it. So if we all agree that we create something that we would all benefit for, each one of us has an incentive to contribute as little as possible and use it as much as possible. So that I contribute very little and I use as much as possible, this is supposed to lead to a deterioration of the good and lead to a tragedy of the commons, which means that everything that is commonly owned would eventually be abused because each individual person has an incentive to overuse it, to use it more than what they contributed. So a mainstream economist, if you would pose them the theoretical question, is collective open source innovation possible, they would tell you no, it would collapse. Because even if you have four people that make the contributions, you would have thousands of people that just abuse them, never give anything back, and eventually consume the good or the service that is offered. So they would give it no chance. They would say it's not sustainable. It would collapse. But we see that COSY is sustainable, and not only sustainable, but also effective. It is effective to a degree in which it replaces commercial products. So it's not only that it does not collapse, but it actually performs better than commercial products that are produced by firms or individuals in ways that we understand and know. Yeah.
In what way do you understand sustainable?
So it's just a thing they want to record you.
In what way do you understand sustainable?
I mean sustainable in the straight English way. I do not mean it as in sustainable development or environmentalism. Just the fact that it does not collapse, that it can be sustained over time. So the second question is, why is it effective? How come it undermines commercial products? So the first question is, why does it survive? The second question is, how come it survives and manages to be better than competing commercial products in which people come to work, they get paid for their work, they do the work, they go home, people make money. So how come that you have something that is done openly by people that do not receive salary, they do not have titles, and yet they manage to produce a product that competes, that in some cases undermines commercial products? So these are two separate questions, and I'm going to address both of them later on. The third biggest question is, even if we can explain the first two questions, can we predict when COSY will emerge? Can we predict in which instances we will see collective open source innovation and in which instances we would not? So we have Apache and we have Linux and we had Napster, but on the other hand, we do not see people voluntarily going out to the street with brooms and cleaning the streets. We do not see that, although this could have been an example of collective open source innovation. So why is it that we see it in some arenas of life, but we do not see it in other cases? So here's the research site and method that we picked attempting to answer these questions. We looked at three Usenet groups, and do I have to explain what is Usenet here? Probably not. We looked at three Usenet groups that are clearinghouse for requests for digital music. The way it works, people post requests to the Usenet group and people post music files to it. There is universal access. It is not moderated. Everyone that has a personal computer and a newsreader can access the group, can post questions, can post requests, can download the files. Everyone can post whatever they want. There is no moderation to the group. We went about systematically analyzing the content, the communication in the group. We analyzed about 2,000 messages that were sent by users. And we used semi-structured interviews to talk to some of the people that either made contributions in terms of posting files or people that posted requests. Now, this research site has some advantages in understanding how collective open source innovation works. First, most of the interaction is observable. There is little private communication. So had we wanted to do the same project on open source development, it would have been much more difficult to collect data in real time. Because open source software could happen offline. People could exchange private emails with each other, to which we do not have access. So we have to ask permission from these people to have access. For the same reason, we could not look at people that write viruses simply because it's very difficult to identify this individual and get to their communication. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, you say interaction is observable, and that might be true, but there are, besides the people who post files and the people who request files, there's a third group that neither post files nor requests them, but downloads them
right.
Nevertheless, and that can be observed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do not have data on that. But I'll get to that later. The interesting thing is the interactions between the first two groups and the third group. The second good thing about this research site is that the interaction is archived. It's asynchronous interaction. It is easy to obtain it and analyze it. So you could say, and we did think about various venues that we could study. One of them was internet chat rooms, for example. The problem with chat rooms is that I would have to have a researcher there 24 hours a day capturing everything that people say on the chat room or on the chat channel. The nice thing about Usenet is that everything is archived. You can just download everything and analyze it at your leisure. Now, there are two competing explanations, competing to the framework that I'll present in a minute. There are two competing explanations that this setting allows us to rule out. One is an explanation that was advanced by Eric von Hippel of MIT and von Krug of, I don't remember his university, it's in Switzerland. They look at the open source software and they try to understand why is it that people make contributions to the open source software. And they say they do it because there are some learning benefits. So people benefit from learning. What people do is they solve software problems, they solve some interesting programming problems, and then they post it, they receive comments on what they do, they receive critique, they improve themselves. So the contribution to open source software are done because people learn from the process of making contributions. This is the argument. Now, in our setting, the goods that offered are generic. These are MP3 files. Nobody learns anything from posting MP3 files. Right? There's no learning here. They just take a CD, they rip it, or they go to their hard drive, they pull up an MP3 file, and they post it. There's no learning here. So if we see the same phenomenon here, when there's no learning, we could pretty much rule out the fact that there are people do it because there are some learning benefits.
Generic?
Yeah. In the sense that it's not specialized. You do not, it's not that you're a musician and you created your own music and you give it to other people that give you comments on that. Right? This could have been learning, but here people just post generic music, commercial music that is available everywhere. The other argument, and these two studies are about open source software, the other argument, Lerner and Tirole, Josh Lerner and Jean Tirole, have a paper in which they say people contribute to open source software because they expect to get good jobs. Because then they could go to an employer and say, well, have you heard about Apache? I'm one of the people that wrote Apache. You know, have you heard about this and that module? I wrote this module. So they say this reduces the risk to the employer because the employer knows that this is a person that actually did something in programming. And it's a sort of advertising yourself. It's like companies that give out free samples. So they give you a free sample, they hope that you will enjoy the free sample, and then you will come back to purchase the full-priced product. What Lerner and Tirole say, people do it in the same way. They sort of give out free samples of their programming work, and then they can go to employers and say, look, I have a good reputation in the open source community, now employ me. Okay? This is another explanation that we can rule out in this setting, because the identities here are cloaked, are hidden. Because what these people do is on the verge of illegality and they know that they copyright holders might come after them, nobody there uses the real identity, nobody there uses the real email address, nobody there posts from any way that can be identified by common people. So there are no reputational effects. And even if they were reputational effects, what kind of reputation could they use? They cannot go to Sony Music and say, I'm the guy that is posting all of your music online, give me a job. Okay? So the advantages of this site is that we have very good access to data. The data is archived, so we can go back and download everything. And it allows us to rule out two alternative explanations. And this is something that you cannot do if you study an open source project, because an open source project, there could be learning, and it could be that people do it to get a better job later on.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you again, but this reputational effects could just be reputational effects within the peer group, within these, let's say, WAS training or MP3 news groups, because I once read basically a news group like this, traded fonts, and there were people who are really, really famous in this environment.
Right.
Everybody knew them, and while they couldn't get a job out of it, it was some kind of reputation within this group that made them famous and might be part of their motivation.
Right. That could be an explanation. There are two problems, or there are two remaining questions. One is that the reputation here is non-fungible, in the sense that you cannot transfer it to other parts of life, right? It is completely non-fungible. So you cannot go to people down the street and say, I'm the great guy that is posting all this music, because nobody knows your real identity. I could say the same thing. Nobody knows who you are, right? There's absolutely no private info. No. So the reputation is not attached to a person, but it is attached to an online identity. And then the question is, why do the people care about the reputation of this online identity? Or in other words, why do people do not try to gain positive reputation by going out and cleaning the streets or painting the houses of their neighbors and so on? Any more questions on this? Yeah.
I think that would be interesting in response to this answers, because if you look at the case of Kevin Minnick, he's so famous that everyone wants to hire him. You know Kevin Minnick?
Yeah.
So once you are called by CIA or FBI, then you are famous.
Yeah.
You
have a reputation. That could be. By the way, Georg von Krug is at Universität St. Gallen in Switzerland. Okay, just to make sure for the record, so he does it too. Okay, here are the findings in brief. Again, because I think that most of the people in this audience are familiar with the way Usenet works, they understand the way open source works, I'm going over the findings only in brief here, but I have the complete paper and there it's very detailed. So the way it works, individuals send requests for files, people post up requests. The benefactor, which is the person that gives something, posts the files in response. Or they could also post voluntarily. We had cases of people that posted the entire discography of U2, for example. They said, I post one album per week of U2. There is no payment. There is no direct exchange, which one way to go about it could have been, here are my files, let me know what you have, and we could do some sort of file swapping. And some people try to do it, but by and large, it doesn't work this way. Right? When Napster was big, the media, at least in the US, the newspapers, thought that this was a platform for people to swap files with each other, to exchange files with each other. And I've been writing letters to the editor, to the Wall Street Journal, to the New York Times, telling them this is not file swapping, this is sharing. Because people do not exchange one with each other, they just open their hard drive. And it took them a while, but now they started to use the term sharing. They stopped using file swapping or exchange. Because there is no payment here and there is no exchange of files. People just post freely. Another interesting thing, it's accessible to anyone. Although technologically these people could have created an internet site that was password protected, and to join in you should have proven that you have some files, you should have proven that you have something you can contribute to the collective, and then once you prove that, or once you pay something, you get in and you can use anything that this co-op or cooperative have created. This is not how it works. It is accessible to anyone. Anyone could, as you said, there are plenty of people that free ride the system, and I think they call them lurkers. They just download stuff. Free riding is common and acknowledged. So in interviews, it came up, they say, yeah, we sure. You know, for every person that posts a file here, there are 10 people that just download stuff and would never post anything. We know that. Although it might sound like chaos, the group actually has strict adherence to established rules. So one of the rules, for example, is that a single person cannot post more than 75 megabytes per day. which is interesting. It shows you that people want to contribute so much that you have to put a limit on how much a single person can contribute. So rather than say you have to contribute something, they say you cannot contribute more than this because you cannot take over the servers. And in one case, we observed a person that was posting a series of albums, and he said, I'm going to post an album per week or so. And then something happened, and he missed one of the posting days. And then he sends a message to the group and says, can I post two albums this week because I missed that something happened and I could not post it? And he receives a response that basically says, we don't care about your schedule. You cannot post more than 75 megabytes per week or per day. So although this person wants to contribute, they say, no, we're sorry, we have rules here, and you cannot just do whatever you want. And if you think about the environment, it's completely open, it's non-moderated. He could technically post whatever he feels like, but he doesn't do it. So although you have an environment that could be a complete mess, there are actually very strong, very established rules, and people adhere to them as to how you behave in this environment. So it's actually far from anarchy in which the way some people might think about the Usenet group. Now, going back to the community point that I made earlier, there's surprisingly little social off-topic interaction. People do not ask, you know, how are you doing? What is the weather in your place? How are the kids? How's your wife? We do not see that. It's all on topic. It's all about requests per music. It's all about posting files or discussing the process of making requests and posting music. And if people start to have a private conversation, even joking with each other, other people post messages saying, this is off topic, do it offline. So again, this goes to the community, which is, if this were a community, we would expect to see more sort of social interaction, chatting and joking, and friendly expressions. We do not see that. Now we are going to the framework. And remember, this framework is based on the Usenet case, but it should apply also to open source software, it should apply to file sharing, it should apply to people that write viruses. So the framework has four legs, and we'll take two legs at a time. The first two legs talk about the sustainability. Why is it that collective open source innovation is sustainable? Why is it that it does not collapse? The two rear legs talk about the efficiency. How come it's not only sustainable, but it's also good enough to undermine commercial products? It's good enough to have an economic impact that really worries commercial companies. So let's start by talking about non-rival goods. A non-rival good is the first leg of the sustainability story. Non-rival good is a term in economics that relates to goods in which one's consumption of the good does not interfere with another consumption of the same good. So examples of rival goods are actually most of the tangible goods that we have in everyday life, food, clothes, housing, for example. So if I wear this shirt, you cannot wear the same shirt at the same time. Your consumption of this shirt would prevent me from wearing the shirt. Only one of us can wear the shirt at a time. We cannot both wear it. If I eat the pizza, you cannot eat the pizza because it's a rival good. It's either me or you, but not both of us. Now, there's a small number of non-rival goods, and quite frankly, in economics, it has not been in the focus of the theory because they are sort of special goods. So it's been some special interesting case. So radio, for example. We can both listen to the same program on the radio. The fact that I listen to the program does not mean that you cannot listen to the program. The same thing is with the roads. The fact that I use the road does not mean that you cannot use the road. Or safety, for example. This is a common example. National security or safety in the streets. The fact that I walk down the streets of Vienna and don't get robbed does not mean that you will get robbed. Because we can both enjoy safety at the same time. Yeah, except if I'm the robber. Now, economists were mostly interested in non-rival goods because non-rival goods are public good that can be abused. So, for example, why do people have to pay taxes? They have to pay taxes because it's difficult to charge people for safety, for example, because anyone enjoys the safety whether they pay taxes or not. So you cannot say if you want to go down the street, you have to give 10 euros to the police officer to pay him for the safety. Rather, you charge taxes from everybody and then everybody gets protected. So, Non-rival goods is one of the things that sustain cozy. Cozy is more likely to be sustainable when the product or service is a non-rival good. Because if you think about it, with a non-rival good, you produce it once and then everybody can enjoy it, whether they contributed something or not. Right? I asked earlier, why is it that people do not go and clean the streets for others? Okay? Why is it that people do not sew shirts or bake breads and just give it to other people? This is because bread is a rival good. So if we all agree that we all bake breads and give them to each other, and I give you a bread, but you do not give me something back, or you do not give something back to the collectives, eventually I will not get anything. I will just be producing breads, but nobody would give me anything in return. This is not the case with non-rival goods. Non-rival goods, I can produce a piece of code, or I can produce an MP3 file, I can give it out, and everybody can enjoy it whether they made a contribution or not. It does not cost me anything, the fact that two people use it or 200 people use it. The cost to me is still the same. So what we argue is that collective open source innovation is more likely when you deal with non-rival goods than when you deal with rival goods. Now, the non-rival good argument explains why is it that if people abuse it, if people do not give something back, there is no economic loss to me. So I wrote the piece of code, I distribute it freely on the internet. The cost to me is the same whether people contribute something back or do not contribute something back, because the cost is in the production of the code. It's not in the distribution of the code. This explains why there is small cost to people to distribute it, and there is very small cost of free riding. What it doesn't explain is why is it that people do not feel exploited? So from a cold, hard economic perspective, you have very little cost. But what about your feeling? Don't you feel exploited knowing that you worked and then there are people that just come, take your work and never give anything back? So we have evidence from psychology that people don't want to be treated unfairly. People want to be treated fairly. More than that, if people see someone that behaves unfairly, they are willing to punish that person even if it costs them something. And the everyday example for that is if somebody drops a banana peel on the sidewalk and you go and tell them you should not do that, you suffer the cost. I mean, you got into a conflict with this person because you felt that they behaved in a wrong way, although it was not personally your business. It did not affect you directly. But we have evidence from laboratory experiments where people are actually willing to pay money to punish someone that behaved unfairly. So the feelings here is something that can drive action. So if people sense that we all agree that we will make a contribution towards some public good, towards some common good, and we see that we make contributions but other people do not make contributions, people tend to withdraw. People say, I don't want to be a sucker. If everybody participates, then I will participate. But if there are some people that do not participate, then I will not participate either, even if there is no economic loss to them. So the second question would be, how come this perception of fairness that gets violated here does not cause people to withdraw from making contributions? Now, here we rely on some interesting recent findings in psychology. And here is what was found both in laboratory experiments and in experiments in the real world. People are less willing to punish an unidentified offender. People are more willing to assist an identifiable beneficiary. So if I ask you a hypothetical question and I say, well, how would you react if someone would just free ride your work, would just use it without giving anything back? You would say, I wouldn't feel about it so well. But when I ask you, how do you feel that George Smith from Boston, Massachusetts, took your work and never paid anything for it and is never going to contribute anything back? You would feel much worse about it. And we have both laboratory and real-world experiments that show that. So when you can identify the people that free ride, you are much more angry about that than if these people cannot be identified. Now, the opposite is true for giving help to people. If I ask you, you know, how would you react if somebody that you do not know would step up to you and ask for help? You would say, well, maybe I would help them. But when I say, I am George Smith from Boston, Massachusetts, and I need your help, you are much more likely to help me than when I just ask you a general question about giving help to someone that you do not know. What we think is that these two effects work in concert, work together, to explain why is it that the perception of violated fairness does not cause collapse in the production of collective open source innovation. This is because the people that make requests are identifiable individuals. And these individuals are more likely to receive help. People are more likely to assist an identifiable beneficiary. The people that free ride are unidentifiable. In fact, nobody knows how many people free ride. So you post an MP3 file in response to an identified person. You know that somebody specifically benefits from your posting. But you do not know how many people just took it and never give anything back. Because of the difference in the effects of these two actions, people can go on contributing because they know that they are helping someone without feeling as bad about the people that just take and never give anything back. So you can think that if you're in an environment in which you see how many people abuse or how many people take without giving back, you will see contributions going down dramatically. Or if you're in an environment in which you are producing something and you do not know who benefits from it, again, contributions will go down dramatically. But this combination in which the people that benefit, the people that write back to tell you how great your software is, or the people that write back to tell you about bugs, these are people that you can identify. You have their name, you have their email, you know where they're from maybe. The people that just take it and never give anything back are unidentifiable. This combination is what prevents this sense of violated fairness. Yeah.
Did you observe these two cases where the went down, when people who were riding were unidentified or were identified? Did you observe these two cases?
No, these are hypotheses. So we have the lab experiment about that, and the puzzling question is that people in the news group say, yeah, sure, we know that a lot of people free ride. So why don't you switch to an environment that is controlled? Why don't you switch to some, you know, password-protected website? Why do you do it in the open? And we think that this is the answer to that.
So don't tell it to the music industry, because they will hire somebody to post, "Hi, I'm John Smith, I just downloaded your file and I won't upload it."
Yeah.
They will.
So these two legs were there to explain how come we do not see it collapse, how come it is sustainable. One is the fact that it did with non-rival goods, which means that people free riding are not that big of a problem. The second is that people that benefit from it are identifiable. They make me feel good because I know that I help someone. People that free ride are non-identifiable and therefore do not make me feel as bad. Now, this is good, but it does not explain why is it that collective open source innovation is so effective. So, you know, these two things could work together and we would have a small bunch of people that produce something and everybody is happy and so on. It does not explain why is it that this is so effective as to become a threat to commercial products. Now we get to the two rear legs of the framework, to the two later elements. The first one is generalized exchange. And generalized exchange is, again, something that comes from sociology. It has been limited to a few number of specialized cases and did not attract too much interest in the mainstream theory. Let me briefly define it. In generalized exchange, when you receive something from someone, you incur an obligation. But unlike direct exchange, the obligation is not to the person that gave you something. It's an obligation towards any other person that is part of the same system. In generalized exchange, you do not have to reciprocate directly. You do not have to pay directly or immediately to the person who gave you something. You do not owe them a favor. You do not owe them anything. You just owe something to the collective. Now, it has been documented in several instances offline. The classic study is Malinowski that did anthropological work in the Pacific Ocean and observed that among islanders. Now, there's more recent work that identifies that among CEOs, in which they do favors for each other, but they do not pay back to each other. They pay back to any other CEO, among immigrant communities, and among lawyers. Now, let me give you a graphical demonstration, because I find that some audiences find it difficult to understand. Because normally when we talk about exchange, we talk about direct exchange. So in direct exchange, which is over there, A gives something to B. And that something could be anything. It could be that they sell them tomatoes. It could be that they do a favor for them. It could be that they give them a piece of useful information. And then B has to pay something back to A. So if the A gave B tomatoes, B has to pay something to A. If A did a favor to B, then B owes a favor to A. If A invited B for dinner, then B is expected to invite A back for dinner. This is direct exchange. In generalized exchange, A does a favor to B, and B does not have an obligation to A now. B has an obligation to anyone else. So if D is in need, then D could go to B and say, can you help me? And B would be obliged to help D because B received something from A. Now, we think the generalized exchange is better than direct exchange to facilitate collective open source innovation. Because generalized exchange allows you to receive contribution from people that you do not know. In direct exchange, you need to know the people that you give to because they have to pay you back. So if there's a new person, you know, can you trust them? Is it worthwhile spending time helping them? Maybe not. So new people cannot enter because nobody would be willing to trade with them. Nobody would be willing to teach them anything. Nobody would be willing to help them because it's not clear that they would pay back or that they have the capabilities to pay back. But with generalized exchange, it's not a problem because I do not expect you to pay me back. I have received my help from other people, and now when you come in, I help you. I do not expect you to help me back. I expect you to help other people, but I do not necessarily expect you to pay me back the favor. This is what lets newbies, for example, participate. Otherwise, nobody would help newbies because they cannot give anything in return, because they do not have anything, they do not know anything. Why would you bother? Why would you waste your time helping these people? It also cuts on the cost of bargaining and transaction. So think about a system in which people ask a question and expect a return. They expect an answer. If this system is based on direct exchange, these people have to show that they are able to pay back the favor before anyone would ever help them. So if I ask for a solution to some programming problem, before people would help me, they would say, show me what you got. Show me how you can be helpful to me. Or if I want a certain MP3 file, people would say, show me your collection. I want to see that you have something that I need before I would help you, before I would give you what you ask for. Now, in generalized exchanges, problem is solved because I do not expect that individual, that specific individual, to pay me back. So this cuts the cost of bargaining and transacting. They do not need to show me their knowledge. I do not need to see their MP3 collection. I help them because they are part of the collective. This is specially fit for knowledge and intangible because knowledge and intangible are difficult to value. It's difficult to know what knowledge somebody has. They can make claims about knowledge, but it's difficult to test it. So generalized exchange is especially suitable when people transact with knowledge or intangible goods. And if you think about the three examples of collective open source innovation that I gave earlier, all of them deal either with knowledge or with intangible goods. So proposition three is that collective open source innovation is more efficient when based on generalized exchange than direct exchange. Finally, and this is the fourth leg of the framework, is you need some coordination institutions. Because what we see here is that the product is a collective product. There has to be some mechanism to coordinate the contributions of these people. So, what happens is the collective develops routines and define acceptable patterns of action. For example, they tell you can post no more than 75 megabytes of music per day. Then they formalize this pattern of actions or these routines and communicate them. And they also designate and man, they put people in certain positions, in certain roles. Now, examples from our specific study is the collective has a designated forum to meet and produce. In this case, it's a Usenet. It could also be a mailing list. But we all know that we meet in a certain place. We all know that we have some place, virtual or non-virtual, to meet and work together. There's a centralized collection of knowledge. There's an archive to which we can go. There's a handbook of procedure. In this group, the FAQ is a handbook of procedure. It tells you exactly how you go about requesting, how you go about posting, what are the limitations, what are the procedures of doing things. And there are enforcers of violations. In this group, there's somebody that is called FAQ man. Nobody knows who is the FAQ man. But if you violate the FAQ, you will receive public scolding from the FAQ man. Now, we argue that these coordination institutions make collective open innovation more efficient. Otherwise, what's the alternative? Think what would have happened if you do not have these coordination institutions. You would have just people making contributions that are not coordinated with each other. So you would have people writing pieces of code that do not fit together. You would have people posting music that nobody is interested in, and requests never get responded. So it's not that just these people just do things because they enjoy giving. They do it in coordination. And this is what makes collective open innovation so efficient in undermining commercial products. Just again, briefly, going over the framework, the first two elements talk about sustainability. What makes it sustainable? How come it doesn't collapse? And I talked about the fact that the goods are non-rival goods and that there is perception of fairness in the process. The two rear elements talk about the efficiency. What makes it so efficient? First, it is based on generalized exchange as opposed to direct exchange. Second, it is coordinated through institutions. People do not just make random contributions. They make contributions that are coordinated by some collective level mechanism. Some conclusions, some thoughts. Collective open source innovation is important in software, but also beyond software. It has implications that go beyond open source software. The framework that we suggest accounts for individual motivation, so it explains why individuals make contributions, but it also explains how the coordination happens. If you think about the two other explanations, one that talks about benefits from learning, the other one that talks about reputation, they do not explain why is it that we see products that are actually coordinated. How come is it that thousands of people make contributions to open source software and the software actually works? Because if these people would just care about their learning or about their reputation, they would just do things that benefit them. They would not solve problems of other people. So here we have both explanation of why do people make contributions and how do these contributions get coordinated. Therefore, it fits more cases than competing explanation, because with this framework, you understand not only open source software, but also file sharing and other coordinated actions online. Also, people that create websites of information in which people write together a book or some sort of a dictionary, this would also be captured under collective open source innovation.
Where's the coordination of file sharing? Where's the coordination of institution in file sharing?
Well, the fact that you have a platform is one of the elements of coordination.
The platform itself can make policies.
Pardon?
The platform itself can make policies.
Right. So when you install certain file sharing programs, they automatically share everything that you have on your hard drive, or automatically share one folder, or automatically share everything that you download. Okay, this is a norm, and this is how it gets enforced. More than that, we offer testable propositions. So we say if these things exist, then open source innovation is more likely to happen. If these things do not exist, it is less likely to happen. It is less likely to be efficient. But still, there are some questions that remain. This framework does not explain everything. It explains some things, but there are some things that are still open questions. How applicable it is offline? Most of the examples, or all of the examples that are gave, are online. Is this something that can happen in the offline world or not? And second, open question is, why is it that some projects are more successful than others? So if you go to SourceForge, for example, there's plenty of products there. There's plenty of projects there. Some of these projects are extremely successful. Some of these projects are abandoned. This framework does not explain why it is that some projects would be successful and some projects would not be successful. I'm done. And I think that I'll give the stage to the next speaker and we can have a conversation or a dialogue later. Thank you very much.
I'm going to talk a bit about networks, about, in particular, about collaboration networks. And yeah, my interest in theory of networks is motivated from a few quite distinct directions. First of all, I'm a scientist, actually a physicist, and to work on theory of networks is a recent, well, game that is popular in statistical physics, and so I'm paid for doing it. Also, one of the communities that has been interest in this field is actually the collaboration network of statistical physicists, so we are a bit self-referential. But thirdly, I have also been involved in some kinds of social movements of the last 10 or 15 years, and I actually perceive many of the patterns that we find in these collaboration networks and also in the theory, the mathematical theory that we are trying to put on top of them, that remind me very much of things that I perceive in these social and political realities. One thing is that the things I'm going to report are results that have been largely obtained through mathematical modeling and mathematical analysis. I will focus on what we have to say. I will not focus on the technicalities and bore you with equations. Few of these results have been obtained by myself. They have been obtained by a quite large community. And I will depart from all scientific code of conduct. I will not give references either to myself or to anybody else. That's why my name is also missing on the front page. I should also say a few things about my general perception of what you are really doing when you are mathematically trying to model social phenomena. Mathematics is a method of formulating tautologies. It's nothing else. So you make some assumptions and then you deduce something from it. And sometimes what you deduce is unexpected, and that's when it gets interesting. And if it is A, unexpected, and B, it somehow matches with something you observe in the real world, then you use the mathematical thing as a metaphor. So mathematical modeling is essentially creation of metaphors. And it's not more than that. So I don't pretend to understand anything in this manner. But you can have nice metaphors and they help you to look at the realities yet that you find in a slightly different manner sometimes, and that's quite nice. Okay, so the image here in the front, by the way, that's a graph of a complex network. It's the internet, how it looked long time ago, about 5 years or so when this map was taken. I also have, at least some of you have seen this little game here. That's a game that's meant to illustrate how email works, actually does not. So you have a sender state message, and you have a little protocol that transmits the message. If it's for you, read it. If you know for whom it is, give it to him. If you don't know, give it to somebody else. You can try this out. Actually, the performance of this protocol depends very strongly who is the sender, who is the recipient, and to whom you give it. If you name somebody you know to live in Vienna and give it to somebody in the street, it will not work. It will take ages to be delivered, and before it is delivered, it will end in some waste paper basket. You can improve the protocol quite dramatically by, say, hand it to somebody you know. By these two words, actually, the protocol is immensely enhanced, and it works much, much better, because then it travels on the network of human acquaintances. However, if the sender and the recipient are, for instance, member of the free software community, and you give it to somebody in the free software community, even if he does not know the recipient, it will be delivered in no time at all. And this is the interesting thing. Why is this so? It has to do with the different network structure of these communities, of the community of acquaintances, of the network of acquaintances, versus the network of the collaborative network that produces free software. And I will argue that this difference in performance actually has to do with the different structure of the networks, and it's this structure of the networks which emerges through a self-organization process, which makes them effective in the sense that they efficiently can transmit information and they can efficiently process information. Now, some definitions. Sorry for that. Okay, a network, formally speaking, consists of nodes and edges, or I will also use the word links. A link is something that connects two nodes, whatever the nodes are. They may be directed or undirected. For instance, in the World Wide Web, a link pointing from one page to the other is directed. In social networks, these nodes may be individuals or groups of them. And the links that I'm interested in are collaborations or acts of communication or acts of exchange. Just a few examples that have been researched. Networks with directed links. The World Wide Web has been extensively researched, and it has served as a kind of paradigm for this whole type of research. We try to understand basically how the Internet and the World Wide Web work. Another network is the network of long distance calls, which are recorded, and so you have a database to look at. Undirected links would be the hardware structure of the Internet or the network of social acquaintances. Usually you assume if you know somebody, then that person also knows you, although this may not strictly be true. How can we characterize a network mathematically? We can draw graphs if the network is small. Quantitatively, we can talk about the rank of a node. That's just the number of connections, for instance, a person has in a network, the number of people he's collaborating with, the number of projects he is involved in. And if we want to look closer, we look typically at correlations. So if we know the property of one person, of one node, to whom does he connect? And are there certain relationships between the people to whom he collects? And in particular, I will talk about one type of networks, which is quite recent, actually, because the material prerequisites for forming these networks exist only for not so long time. And these are networks for which a characteristic rank does not exist. A characteristic rank means that, on average, a person will have links, for instance, acquaintance links with this and that number of people, say 50. He will collaborate in a scientific collaboration with some 10 people. And so you could argue, okay, that's the characteristic number of people persons are linking to. However, there are networks for which this makes not really very much sense. These networks are called scale-free, which means that a characteristic rank does not exist. Actually, in practice, it means that there are certain people who are involved in incredibly many collaborations. Although the average number of collaborations per person may be about 3 or 4, that's the result which we have for the network of statistical physicists, there are people who are involved in literally thousands of collaborations. And these people are important in several respects. And so if you look at the distribution of links, of the number of links, then we can say that a scale-free network is one for which this distribution decays according to some power law. And it means really that there is a limited small number of persons which have very many connections. Then there is a larger number of persons which have lots of connections, but not that many. And so it goes on and on and on. And of course, there is a large number which have only one or two connections. But the structure is not hierarchical. There is not the important ones and the unimportant ones, but it is a continuum that interpolates between the two. And so I think this is an important thing. Yeah?
No, just to clarify.
Yeah?
Does the definition require that there are a couple of nodes that have a lot of ties? Or what if everybody is connected to everybody? What if everybody is working with everybody? Wouldn't that be a scale-free network?
If everybody is connected to everybody, then it would be a very strange network.
But we are in the world of theory.
If everybody would be connected to everybody, it's a network that does not exist. For sure, we know that. Mm-hmm. We are talking here about huge networks, networks that, in the case of the scientists' network, involve about 20, 30,000 people. In the case of the web, the number of web pages on the web, it involves billions of pages. And they are not all linked to each other. It would be quite dysfunctional.
Okay, but would that be would that fit the definition of scale-free network? I'm trying to
understand. The formal definition, it would be a scale-free network with exponent 0, which is not observed. The exponents are between 2 and 3.
Good.
Formally, yes, just mathematically speaking. I oppose this to a classical network that lives on a plane, in this case, the area of the United States of America, the U.S. power grid. And this network is quite different. There is practically no nodes, which have nodes is just a point where several power transmission lines join. There is no nodes that have a degree of much larger than 5, basically. They get exponentially rare, and they are practically non-existent. So social examples for such scale-free networks are the network of scientific collaborations in physics, the network of email exchanges, the network of long-distance calls. The problem is, which you encounter when you do mathematical modeling, is that you want to quantify what a connection is. Now, if some people have co-authored, for instance, a scientific article, then you say, okay, they have collaborated, so you know what a collaboration is. You also know what an email exchange is. Somebody has sent an email to somebody. You know what a long-distance call is. And all these things have the advantage of being archived in databases, which you can search and where you can do statistics. Acquaintance and friendship are much more hard to define and to get a strong grip on them. You have to do much more work. You have to fill questionnaires and do interviews, and still you get only a loose notion. Still, you can try to do it. What happens is that these networks are not scale-free. There is a characteristic number of persons, of acquaintances a person has. And the question is, what is the difference? And I will try to answer this question in a short moment. This is just trying to sketch a traditional network where you have a characteristic number of connections for each person, and it can go crisscross. And a scale-free network where you have hubs, where you have strongly connected nodes, and you have hubs of all degrees. You have very strong hubs, very weak hubs, smaller hubs, and so on, down to some people who are just linked at the periphery. And now I'm going to argue that essentially these scale-free networks emerge in a quite simple manner through a self-organization process. You don't have to do anything to build them. But first, why do we care? I mean, all what's this business of scale-free about? Why is it? What is exciting about it? Well, if you analyze the properties of these networks, then you find some quite nice properties. First, it is that they have a small world property. Small world means it's an effect all of you know. You meet somebody and you have never seen this person before, and you talk to him for 5 minutes, and you find a common acquaintance. It has this small world property in social networks is a very old story. It has been in the 60s discovered by Milgram, who said there is 6 degrees of separation. If you travel along a path between acquaintances, you cut from every person in the States to everybody else. So these networks have this small world property, but you don't have to be scale-free to have it. In the World Wide Web, it means that if you know the right path, you can get from every page to every other in 9 mouse clicks. If you don't know the right path, you don't get there, even if you click for a very, very long time. Another important thing is they are resilient. What does it mean? Suppose you have a network of collaborators and then certain of them decide to drop out. And many of them decide to drop out. When does the network actually fall apart? Fall apart in the sense that people who are still in the network can no longer communicate with each other because there is no longer a connection. The answer is if you have a scale-free network, it's completely resilient. That is, as long as there is still any finite percentage of people left in the network, it still ties together. And this is a very important property. So if such a collaboration network has been established, then if people just randomly drop out, it will not be destroyed. So it is sustainable in this sense. Then you can ask, how do we have to increase the bandwidth in the network, the information transmission capacity, if new persons come in? If new collaborators come in, they will communicate with everybody else, so the traffic load on everybody else will tend to increase. Actually, the bandwidth that you need is less for a scale-free network than for a conventional one. So you have to increase the bandwidth by a smaller amount. It's easier to incorporate new members. They have some funny data transmission properties. Actually, they are not very good in directed transmission of information, which is funny in a sense, because the internet works after all, or has this structure. If there is large fluctuations in the data load, then these scale-free networks have a tendency to overload the hubs, the strongly connected nodes, and they become bottlenecks. But another interesting thing is that non-standard transmission protocols work extremely well on these networks. A non-standard transmission protocol is a rumor-spreading protocol. That is, information is not targeted, sent from one person to another or to a group of persons, but a rumor is spread. And if people meet, if people get into contact, then with a certain probability, the rumor will be propagated to the next person who can then communicate it to others, etc. Now, scale-free networks are incredibly efficient in rumor-spreading. So the rumors travel in a very fast way. They propagate over the network very fast, and they reach a significant number of members on the network in a short time. The backdrop to this property is that they are very susceptible to viral spreading. A virus is nothing but a rumor. If you got it, there is a certain probability that you can transmit it to somebody else to whom you are in contact. And as it happens on a scale-free network, it's not possible to get rid of virus. You can actually not eradicate a virus once it is there. Now, the interesting thing from my point of view is also that these networks form by self-organization processes. So if we ask, how can we construct such a network? We don't have to go to great hassles, but we can devise a very simple way how they form naturally. I want to address a few more properties that are not about scale-free behavior, but they exist in real scale-free networks. One is clustering. So if I collaborate with somebody and somebody collaborates with a third person, then it's very likely that we form a cluster of three and have a collaboration also along the third edge. So essentially, these networks form, they divide into clusters, but the clusters are among them connected in such a manner that still the global connectivity of the network is very efficient. And then there is something which is called assortative mixing, which means essentially that important nodes, nodes that have a lot of links, tend to connect among each other. So the important guys, the big guys, they tend to mate. Now, what are the conditions for forming such networks? One important condition, and that's, I would say, the reason why these networks are new in the sense that we have discovered them, or they have been discovered only a few years ago. One condition is that there must be no links to form, limits to form links. So you should be able to form very many links, and you should not be impeded by such a thing like your geographical distance. So such a scale-free network cannot live on the surface. You should not be limited by geographical distance. Think of a medieval society. You can build links of collaboration only with people, say, some 10 miles apart, because that's the distance you can walk in a day. So if, but also if you are limited by, say, mail exchange, it's still very difficult to maintain collaboration between you and a person in India. So in the in this sense, as long as you don't have efficient means of communication, then you are earthbound in your networking. And as long as you are earthbound, you cannot form a scale-free network. It's impossible. Also, if you exclude forming rules, if you try to build a firewall against around the community, then it cannot get scale-free. One important thing is that all these networks that we research and that show this scale-free property are actually growing. The World Wide Web is growing continually. Collaboration networks are continually growing. New people are coming in. And this, it's this growing which actually makes the self-organization process operative. And then the key ingredient is what we call preferential attachment. And that's a very simple thing. In order to build a link of collaboration with somebody, I must know about him. The probability that I know about him is proportional to the number of collaborations of links which this guy has already. If you think of a web page, to put a link on a web page, I must A, like it, but B, I must know about it. The probability that I know about it is directly proportional to the number of links that point to that page. That's what's called preferential attachment. And if you put these things together and put them into equations, you will see that this immediately produces scale-free behavior. Actually, obstacles, you should not be earthbound. Also, an obstacle is aging. Scale-free networks tend to be young. Young, in the sense of the network, means after a certain time, people may get old, they may die, they may disappear, they may be no longer able to sustain or to create links or collaborations. And if this happens, it tends to destroy the scale-free structure and it tends to promote what is called assortative mixing. So you form old boys networks. You form networks of people that are very long in the business, that are very well connected, that mate up preferentially among each other. And then this is not, of course, mathematics, but it's just a statement, and they tend to yield power. But they actually are not functional for the network as a whole. They destroy actually many of its nice properties. So, well, that was some of the results. Now I want to come up with some theses that are non-mathematical in nature mostly. I think that these self-organized networks are interesting as tools, as they are basically tools and machines for information exchange, for collaboration, and for production. I think they are really machines for production in a sense that in the structure of the network there is encoded a kind of knowledge, there is encoded paths which allow me to find information. I can ask somebody who will point me to somebody who will know who will have written this routine already, which I would like to have. And This is much more efficient than trying to just find a few nice keywords, put a long search string, and put it into Google. It does not work, as we all know. These networks, a very interesting question that has interested me also from the point of modeling is, what does hierarchy mean in these networks? In a sense, they are not non-hierarchical, because there are people who are very well connected and who have a lot of, therefore they have a lot of access to information. If some new information comes into the network, they will see it earlier than some person who is at the periphery. Also, if somebody wants to spread a rumor in the network, it makes a huge difference whether this person is at the center or if at the periphery. A rumor that comes from the center propagates much, much faster. If I want to spread information, I tell it to somebody, and you tell it to somebody, and it propagates like that. Then, if you are a well-connected hub, you are very efficient at that. If you are at the periphery, you are not at all. Which means that at the end, there are persons who have a high degree of connectivity, who have are much more efficient in decision making in such networks, because they can easier get access to information, they can easier disseminate information without any formal hierarchy being implemented. So, what I find important is the mathematics behind this does not contain any individual traits. It does not contain any personality issues. It does not contain cultural issues. It's a very abstract, meager thing, and still it produces hierarchy. So to me, it tells more or less, it may not be the main problem of a personal virtue, that some persons want to take responsibility and be very nice and be very responsible for the whole thing. It's also not a thing of personal misconduct, that people are just greedy to get power. But it is something that somehow emerges out of self-organization by association in a more or less natural manner. However, this hierarchy that comes out of this process is in a sense reflecting the functionality of a person in the network, because he has this access to information because he's basically the person who is also overloaded with information and is trying to communicate it everywhere. It's inherently transient. If you leave these networks in their development, then the most connected, the most important people will not remain the most important people. And being an anarchist, or what in Anglo-Saxon terms is called an anarchist, I don't like the term, I would say that maybe these hierarchies are inevitable. I perceive them in social movements which are anti-hierarchical. They still produce hierarchies. And you can see them, you can see these hubs. We all know them, basically. I think this is not the important issue. The important issue is that for the functionality of these networks, it is that the hierarchy does not condense into a kind of old boys network, that it does not become crystallized in a institutional structure. I would object to the use of institutions, actually. Because then, hierarchy is still there even if it has become dysfunctional. Even if the person is not doing anything useful in the sense of the common goal anymore, still he has a position where he can say, okay, we must go into this direction, okay, we don't go into that direction. Maybe he's no longer communicating with people at the periphery who are new, who may bring in new ideas at all anymore. Still, he is in a central position. If this is secured by formal hierarchy, I would argue that it becomes dysfunctional. So I think that to keep this type of networks operative, it is instrumental to have a constant challenging of hierarchy while accepting that it is there, actually. So that's more or less the story I wanted to tell. And yeah.
Discuss on whatever we are interested in.
So, Absolutely. I have answers to your last questions. Could you reiterate those two questions? The first question is your model about causes your disease offline? And my answer is yes. And then you ask why. And I have my own explanation. And this explanation also could become a suggestion to your research. So why am I saying yes? Because looking at our daily life, of course people like to share everything when they're sharing the same interest. For example, yesterday I went to a very nice restaurant in Vienna, and parents said, today I talked to someone here, even though we don't know each other, then I told him, oh, the food there is excellent. And he's also a vegetarian as me, and he probably will be interested. So even though we don't know each other, and we just met for 1 minute, but he would definitely want to get information from me. So of course, I'm very willing to tell him, because I think everyone who likes food should go to a nice restaurant to enjoy the food, so we share the same interests. So that's the reason why I think the model of your works in daily life actually could pick up everywhere. Hence my explanation about the shared interest will explain. And also I think sometimes in the beginning you were saying in your research that in this virtual environment you can't see much interactions. So you say there are little social information and interaction, and you also say there's a strong orientation to accomplish goals rather than preserve relationship, which I totally disagree, because all the kind of motivation is based on shared interest, and because of this shared interest, and it's like a friendship, you're actually building up your friendship, and it's a community. And I think your explanation about community, the definition is too limited, because community is not only happen, it's not just subject to the family, the family relationship, actually could be diseased very wide. And so, for example, a conference like OpenLooks or other hacker conferences, they are just providing platforms where people share the same interest in Linux or free software and to get together and to share information. And so, again, because it happens offline, because when we are here, we are offline, and it happens everywhere. And my suggestion to your further some reading practice you could have is to read something about a community of practice or a community of interest.
Disagree. Thanks. No, I think that your idea about sharing information is a good one, and it's something I have to think about it more. There's some evidence that of people that looked at people that do extreme alpine sports. It actually was in Bayern and in Austria, so we're not very far from the research sites, and this is an example, this could be an example of collective open source innovation. What these people did, they did their crazy skiing and they had to create some special gear for that because this gear did not exist in the stores. And what they did is somebody invented new skis or created or improved the new skis, and then they would have a gathering every month and people would show each other the new skis that they developed. And this is the way they transmitted the information. Now, this could be a case of collective open source innovation. I just have to think how it fits into the model and why is it that it fits into the model. But this is definitely a good idea. As to the community, the problem is that in everyday life, community is a word that has come to become everything and nothing. And it's has a lot to do with the American English that has... distributed this term and used it to explain everything or to name everything. Now, there are some cases in which people interact, and they're not a community, they interact because they have some shared interest in gaining something, they cooperate, they collaborate, but the term community in the scientific sense has to do with a group of people that where their primary interest is in maintaining their relationship. It's like a group of friends where, why are you with these people? Because I enjoy being with them, because the relationship is important for me. If you are with them to get a goal, to to achieve a certain goal, it would not meet at least not the scientific definition of community. So people that work together in a company are not a community. They are there to accomplish a goal. They might be friends, but their primary reason for them being there is to accomplish a goal.
I don't know, I just want to say one or two words on the same issue. I think looking at the collaboration networks I have been involved in, I think there are two issues. Of course, there are a few friends. You make friends there. Of course, you get acquainted with people and it develops into a friendship, and then it has a dimension that is out with the collaboration, the collaborative effort. But on the other hand, there are many more people with whom I collaborate, and we are not friends. I mean, we appreciate each other, but that's it. I mean, I don't have to, and it makes life much easier. I mean, you don't have to bother about this or that, and I don't have to bother whether this guy is politically correct or not, because I'm working with him on a physics problem, so it's much easier. It's possible, and I think also in the social movements, as far as I can perceive it, these collaborations are very efficient if there is a simple target. Let's put an Indymedia center in this and this place at the summit. It works very efficiently. On top of this, there are friendships, but it's not the same thing.
Very quickly. Of course, there's not only friendship in a community, and I think relationship could be defined very differently. For example, collaboration could be some kind of relationship as well. Hence, I don't think that only friendship could be existed in a community. And of course, this is about definition, and as long as it's defined very well. And I personally prefer to define community and relationship in a very broad terms, and I think relationship is happening everywhere, no matter your enemy, is kind of relationship as well. So
I wanted to ask you from the business school, Xin.
Yeah.
And I want you to say that these cozy systems are competing successfully with businesses. What do you see as somebody who is teaching at the business school as the role of businesses in these processes?
Well, it's an interesting question because, as I said, we do not fully understand causes. So it's a phenomenon that is out there in the real world, but we do not have a good scientific explanation of where it comes from, how it is sustainable, why it would not go away, why it works in some instances and does not work in other instances. I can give you some facts that we know. We know, for example, that a lot of people that make contributions to the open source software are people that either do it after work hours by using their employer equipment or actually doing during work hours. So there are some businesses that actually actively contribute to open source software by giving their employees the time and the equipment to participate in open source development. Now, again, it's not clear why they do it or how they benefit from it or if they benefit from it. But as we go and understand more about it, then the business world will understand more about it. But right now they play some sort of a passive role. They adopt the products of the open source software. Some of them make contributions to the open source software, but there are a lot of things that are going on exactly because it is an emerging phenomenon. We do not have a good understanding of it.
I just wondered if you'd considered wireless community networks in any of your research.
But could you say a couple of more?
Wireless things, networks where people are establishing their own nodes and maybe establishing sort of social, physical organizations as well through that. Maybe that was a race to speak.
Yeah. This is actually a good example of collective open source innovation. I did not think about it, but now that you mentioned it, I think it's a good example, again, because this could have been easily limited to people that make contributions. And actually, there is such a group next to where I live in Copenhagen. They set up their own network. It's a wireless network, but you need a password. And to get a password, you have to pay them. So this is a cooperative. They all buy the equipment together. They share the equipment, but it's not open source because you have to pay to participate. And on the other hand, we in San Francisco, for example, you just can just walk down the street and you identify a wireless network and you can just log in and use it. And the same thing is going on in New York. There are certain hot zones in New York where you can do it. That's a good example. I'll add it to the paper. Thanks.
I think that there's more and more knowledge in commercial companies in the interest, for example, of what IBM is doing in this area, how they use those open source and development methodologies and cooperation work to drive their own business in a certain way. IBM was giving $40 billion amount of software to the open source community, and what was the reason why they have done it? And the reason was that they had no real chance to earn money just directly because of the competition situation. So what they thought is that they give it free to the open source movement, and in this way that's the only chance that they compete against Microsoft in this case in the development tool environment. And on the other side, what they reached also is that their own development platform was unified on this new open source stuff, which IBM was never able to unify their internal development. Everybody was using something different. Since they now have introduced this open source stuff and given it free, and it's now not totally controlled by IBM anymore, and there are hundreds and thousands of developers now testing this stuff and giving away their idea, then they succeeded to normalize their own development. Everybody's now putting their stuff on this new platform. Mm-hmm. And even also Microsoft's discussion internally, that they use a lot of these technologies internally, the free communication and this spontaneous cooperation to be more competitive against other companies. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, even if the sociology doesn't yet really understand the companies, they don't understand. They can use the mechanism not only for the positive political stuff.
Yeah. It could be that what we will see in the future is, so we have two established ways of producing something. People can produce it alone as individuals. Now imagine a big fruit market where people, you know, grow their own tomatoes, go to the market and try to sell it, and others go to the market and try to buy it. Or we have firms, which is a collective of people. They produce something in common, they are all getting paid for it, and they go home. Now it could be that the collective open source innovation is a third form of production. It's an emerging form of production. It's a form of production that could have been done in the past, but was not as efficient because of technological limitations. So here I actually agree with Michael. Technology enables it, but technology did not create it. It was there all the time, but you take the inclination of people to do something and you combine it with technology, and all of a sudden you get this third player which creates innovation, creates economic goods and services in a way that it is obviously not created by individuals, it is obviously not created by firms, it is a new form of player, it's a new economic actor. And this is why it's so interesting to study, especially in the context of a business school, because business, all of a sudden, is not just companies, it's also open source innovation. Question for me or for Micah?
I didn't understand it, so I just acoustically didn't get it.
Okay, I'll try again. I was just asking
Do you have any insights on how small firms, how small firms can use, apply open source?
Maybe you can say a couple of additional words as to why small firms are different from individuals or big firms.
Well, my thoughts are small firms aren't in a position to compete with the big guys. Therefore, they're not going to use open source as sort of the equivalent of David Sling. Does that help?
They're not going to use open source?
So, therefore, it might be useful for them to use open source as the equivalent of David Sling.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. I yes, I like the image. It's not really clear why there would be an effect of size there. The nice thing about open source is that the more people use it, the more likely it is that somebody will make a contribution. So as I said in the talk, because it's an unrivaled good, it doesn't matter if there are 1,000 people that free ride, as long as some of them give back something, as long as some of them do something back to improve the quality of the software, and could be something as small as reporting a bug, which is a contribution, or something as big as writing the core of the software. So is it good for small businesses? It is probably is, because it saves the money, but it also saves money to big businesses and it saves money to people. So it's a nice arrangement because everybody benefits from it.
I would also comment, I think that it is easier, it may be easier for small businesses because they are closer to individuals in a sense, to plug into the production of free software. So to use basically the production of free software to produce something that suits their particular needs, because it's easier if you are a small number of people to get involved and to find others who may be interested in the same, in solving the same problem. So I can see that it might be easier for a small company actually to make free software development serve their particular needs and develop actually custom-made software, effectively develop custom-made software for them, which then is of course also available to anybody else. I think that in a huge company, just because of the issue of mediation, of definition of problems, of hierarchy, it's just a bit more difficult, although in principle it's possible as well. So
the large part of this conference goes about question if it is possible to take the open source model to produce viable goods. What's that?
Which are viable.
Viable. Viable.
But this is interesting. Of course, as you can learn from my model, I think that collecting open source innovation will be less efficient in producing viable goods. But, you know, we were wrong about collecting open source innovation from the beginning, because we would have predicted it would fail.
Yeah, I would also emphasize that the distinction between rival and non-rival goods is actually blurred. Because if you think of an absolutely rival good, that is a car. You cannot, if I drive my car, you cannot drive my car. That's quite obvious, unless you're in the back seat. However, if you think of the money you pay for the car, there are actually, nowadays you pay a large amount of the money for the cost of developing the car, of making the designs, and a very small amount of the is for the material production. Now everything that can be put on file can be reproduced at zero cost, and is in this sense a non-rival good. Whereas the material part of the car, which makes then 3,000 quid out of the 10,000 that it costs, is a rival good. So what follows from that? I don't know. Maybe you know.
I think that what Michael pointed out is actually a great answer, which I did not think about, which is that when we think about products, we should think about which part of them is rival and which part of them is non-rival, and the part that is non-rival can be used in the process of collective open source innovation. So maybe you cannot distribute the cars, but you can distribute plans that would allow people to build their own cars, essentially. So follow on your example.
Another remark, but some of the obviously viable goods today are especially food, you have sugar or something else. We have so many of them that we actually burn it, and so why, in some senses, it is a non-rival good, because we have enough of it to throw it away.
This is true, and then here we get into questions of agricultural subsidies in Europe, which is a very sensitive topic.
Not just the European agriculture, also the coffee bean, the Southern American coffee, people keep their coffee beans on the bushes because it doesn't sell, it doesn't make money from them. So it's not just European.
I want to illustrate another issue of rival versus non-rival good, which puts in kind of strange, puts the distinction in a strange light. Think of a Nike t-shirt. To produce the t-shirt costs, I don't know, 50 pence. To buy it costs you 50 quid. What is the difference? That's a very strange thing. Is it just that everybody is completely stupid to buy it and buy something that is worthless at a high price? Or just are all these people nutters? I don't think so. There is another good which I would believe to be a non-rival good, which comes into this product, and it is style. And it is produced by many people, by many street kids. They produce the style, and everybody can produce the style. And if I have the style, it does not mean that you cannot have the style. Although the style is built on distinction, but everybody can, in principle, have another touch of the style. Of course, Nike spends a lot of money, and that's what they are paid for with these 50 quid, to appropriate this style, to put a brand on it. And this is incredibly expensive. I mean, that's what is the main part of their budget. So they are really paying for this. But in principle, the good that is behind it, the style, I would say is an open good. And it is produced in an open production process, in a sense. So the question is, well, have our own brands? I don't know.
What was the last remark?
Well, should we create our own brands? Well, okay, I'm not very efficient in it, but...
Perhaps I could share a bit of my idea. Because I have this idea of marketing culture. I'm always very interested in the culture of marketing. So I'm thinking of how to market a hacker culture. You put this hacker culture as kind of very stylish, new trend. And so embed it in some kind of a product and try to push people to buy it. And so people not only buy the product, they also pick up a sense of the hacker ethics. I mean, could implement it in their daily life and kind of DIY culture. But I don't know, I haven't found anything very, very easy to kind of find the customers very easy. Personally, I think software programming somehow needs some kind of knowledge. It's like not like a changing rooms, you know, the kind of a TV transmissions about changing rooms that you could buy the pens and just change the interior design in your house. And then software somehow could become kind of pens or small tools that you could get in just to improvise by yourself. I don't know, I just have this crazy idea about marketing hacker culture. I don't know whether it will work or not.
How come you don't care about the difference between free software and open software? Because it seems to me that every free software is also open, but not every open software is free. Like every poodle is a dog, but not vice versa.
Yeah.
How come you confirm or mix that and you don't care about the difference?
How would the difference matter? Maybe I'm missing something.
It seems to me that Mac OS is a product, is a commodity that you have to buy, but you can see the code.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not free software because you have to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And many people are here just for the purpose to exchange about free software and to see what makes things scarce. And what laws and what wishes of people found the basis of scarcity. And what you said, that this is a touchy subject, it's only a touchy subject for people who want to to stay with capitalistic ideas. And many are here just to question this.
Mm-hmm. That's good. This is a distinction I should think about. Maybe I'm mixing two things that should not be mixed.
It's not true.
No?
What? I don't know exactly what you mean, but macOS X is based on BSD. At least the BSD parts from macOS X are free. Free in the sense of the open source initiative and free in the sense of the Free Software Foundation, at least as far as I know.
Yeah.
The BSD license allows people to add proprietary additions to it to close them down. This is different to the GPLS, but and this is probably the case with Apple software, but which they put on top of this.
No, that's not that. That's not the end of the ministry.
Yeah, that's not the end. But this is not the case with other license software. But this is, well, to my knowledge, this is the only big example where the BSD license is used in that way. Maybe there are more examples, but this is the only one where I know from.
Okay.
I personally think that it's not only a distinction between rival and non-rival goods. I mean, the problem is that, for example, if you, this was an example of the software company building some very special software, and they license it there, but they must, so where they produce a software for a large public, then they give it for free. I mean, this is if you buy, if a lot of production work is something singular, like build a bridge in a certain place. I mean, this is, it's, I mean, what I think is that there's always this, this is a very important point, that it's, we are always speaking about a certain kind of production, like software production, that it is cooperative, ideas works easily because you can produce independent modules. No? Someone can improve an algorithm and can post it there. Of course, yes, the dependent part. It's hard to imagine how you build a bridge in this paradigm. That's because there are more, much more stringent ways to do it. What you can do, of course, is to have those ideas how to build bridges. Yeah. This could be a cozy way to have concepts or to invent technologies in this way, but to build the bridge itself is a very well formed, well organized process. I don't know yet any bridge built in a way similar to open software. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
So, even as simple as that, you just need a machine to build the bridge. Is there anything which prevents inventing such a machine?
But I mean, the principle that there is a certain
there's a certain way to have creativity in this process, which at the same time you have to plan the work, and I don't think that you can totally replace this work. You can of course make more doable in an algorithmic form and reduce this part, but there's still in a lot of construction they have to be very well planned. Even the machines or whatever you use, they have to do this in a very planned way. Of course, if you have the algorithm do it, then the algorithm does planning or whatever, but I mean, that's very far away from the scale.
But isn't this just another challenge for another engineer?
I'm not sure, but maybe the machine that Stefan was mentioning is those networks that Michael was talking about. I mean, thinking about what makes free software development, open source development special, it seems to be that networking, the ability to use the technologies, to tweak the technologies, maybe also something like social skills. So people say this code of conduct, and you know, you have to really learn how to ask your questions and how to communicate them in the free software communities. So maybe that is a machine, but maybe it would be interesting to look at the ways how different networks are different machines that produce different things. So there's the free software community, whatever machine, and maybe there's the scientist's machine. I have no idea what they produce. Something like the radical movements, global protest production machine, which probably functions slightly different again. I'd really like to hear a bit more about distinctions or similarities and overlaps.
I think that's a good point, and heard my presentation, I'm struggling to extend the boundaries beyond just open source software, and I think that there are plenty of different machines out there that produce different things. So because it is Equinox and not the open source conference, I would again point out that according to the most reliable surveys that we have about what people do online, we know that about a third of the internet users in the US alone made some sort of contribution, and it could be they wrote a piece of open source code, they uploaded files, they posted information on a website, and these are 35 million people in the US alone. Now, you can think, if you can do some sort of extrapolation and find that we're talking about probably hundreds of millions of people worldwide. And, you know, whatever piece of information today, you need to know how to fix your car, or you want to plan a trip to Antarctica, you type it into Google, and sure enough, somebody somewhere has a document online that would explain to you how to do it. So there are plenty of machines that produce a lot of products and services that other people use for free, which is a fascinating phenomenon.
I would say one very important issue in this context is actually that the users of the web are producing the tools for navigating the web in a useful manner. That is, in terms of blogs and all these kinds of things, which are really much more useful than Google actually is, because Google gives you too much information. Whatever you put in, you are never hitting the point.
Google is based on the Google ranking is based on the information of the links of the users itself.
Yeah. Yeah, but of course you get. If you are now a member of the community, you're interested in, for instance, traveling people who like to travel to Antarctica, and you look at the blog of one of them, you immediately get a lot of useful links. If you go to Google, you have to sort out 10 useless links for one useful that you find. Basically, that's the only problem I want to point.
If you go to where? If you go where, it's better.
If you know some member of the community of people who travel, and you just look into his blog, it's much easier.
Into his what?
It's much easier to find something useful. By blog.
Okay.
Another thing in this direction about networks. The real social networks are more networks of networks, and is there any mathematical thing about networks of non-scale, non-scale networks? And is there something special with it, or are they simply the same in the mathematical way?
Mathematics, as I said, is metaphors. So
yeah,
don't believe too much really. But I think that one interesting thing is that, of course, the network can be always divided into many sub-networks. But actually, it does not really match, because I'm a member of this group, social movements. I'm a member of this group, and I appear as a member of this sub-network. But then in a completely different context, I appear also as a physicist that is giving a talk here. And so you may come across me in completely different contexts, still it's the same network. So the subdivision into different networks, it's not possible to subdivide, I think, a web of social interactions in a hierarchical manner. To say this is the level of the basic groups that I cannot just send to do, decide to do it, of the revolution. of some Basisgruppen or Affinitätsgruppen. And then you have some other, this old method, hierarchical idea of the red democracy. I think it's not like this. It's much more complex. It's overlapping. You have different levels of hierarchy that are interspaced in a completely irregular manner. And you encounter this guy at this meeting, and in a completely different context you encounter him there. Sometimes he appears for this group, sometimes he appears for that group. So what is it? It's, I think, this way of neatly dividing things and devising a way how they should work, it is not clear.
Yes, my question goes, if in a non-scale network, you have hubs with many connections,
yeah.
And in a scaled network, it's not so common to have different kinds of hubs. And my question is, if every people is in many networks, and in one he is the strong part, and then another is at the periphery. And so what happens if we merge this network? What get we? Get we a non-scaled network or a scaled network?
Okay, depends on how you merge. Generally speaking, if the network structure on the highest level is scale free, it tends to be robust. The scale free behavior tends to be robust.
Sorry, can you say that again?
The scale free behavior, if it is once there on a very large scale level, then it tends to be robust. It does not disappear so easily. So if you subdivide, for instance, it does not get lost.
Right, yeah, but what is if you merge some more than one scale-free network together?
If you merge them according to the same rule of preferential association, then it just gets the same.
I've got one more question for Jean. You explained in your framework that people are basically not in it for reputation because they've got other reasons. But how do you then explain that they care about being punished, quote unquote? Because basically it's no real punishment. And how are these rules, like this 75 megabytes of files or whatever, enforced if they don't care about their reputation, and that's basically everything that can be communicated in this network?
No, I might be misunderstand you. I presented the reputation and the learning effects as competing explanations.
Yeah.
They try to explain what I explain in a different way. I think they're incorrect.
You say this reputation is not enough of an explanation for all these phenomena that are happening here.
Right.
How come you now use it to explain your theory? Do you see basically, because I can't find another explanation why this this punishing works if it wasn't for reputation, because why else do people care about being punished or about rules, about norms,
yeah.
or conventions in this society, or whatever you call it?
Well, one explanation is that they accept the rules because they understand that the rules there are to facilitate the collective effort. So they understand that if they follow the rules, everybody would be better off. Now, I'm not saying that there is no reputation in collective open source innovation. There is definitely reputation. The point is that the reputation is not sufficient to explain why would people make contributions, especially to the case that we studied, which is the music case, in which this reputation is useless. You cannot do anything with this reputation. So you have to make a very strong argument that the reputation there is, this is some case of very weird people, that the reputation for their online identities is so important for them that they would spend all this time reading requests and posting files.